The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Today's topic is internet identity, and our guest is Eve Mailer. Eve Mailer is ForgeRock's interim CTO. She's a globally recognized strategist, innovator, and communicator on digital identity, security, privacy, and consent, with a focus on fostering successful ecosystems and individual empowerment. She founded and leads the User Managed Access, UMA, standard effort, and provides expert advice to forums such as Open Banking. Previously, Eve co-invented the SAML and XML standards. And in case you were wondering, SAML stands for Security Assertion Markup Language, and it is an open standard for exchanging authentication and authorization data between identity providers and service providers. XML stands for Extensible Markup Language. XML is used to describe data, and it's a flexible way to create information formats and electronically share structured data. Welcome, Eve.
Thank you so much.
It's been a while since we saw each other, Eve.
Indeed. It's exciting to be here.
Yeah, we had some fun back in the day at some of the Liberty Alliance identity management and technology workshops and standards development meetings. So what would you like to tell us to kick this off? What would you like to tell us that digital identity is in 2020?
Digital identity in 2020 is, well, it's evolving, I think, partly because we have this rapidly evolving conversation about data privacy. We've got regulations. We have some people up in arms about it. And, you know, digital identity has long been about a bundle of data that uniquely identifies us, that needs to be managed over time, that helps us authenticate to digital systems to get important things done. And more we find ourselves sort of fighting to be known properly, accurately, and to be defended properly from bad guys. As always, I think there's been a core of people, I guess myself among them, and yourself among them, who care deeply about what digital identity means, because identity is important. You know, our identity is important.
Right. And so, Eve, can things have digital identity?
You know, things can absolutely have digital identity. Yeah.
And what kind of problems does that cause?
Well, I think we've seen so many Internet of Things security challenges in large part because we've seen them have identity theft problems. I mean, in a nutshell, when you see things like default passwords remaining on smart devices, those, I think those are pretty much identity theft problems of those smart devices. That's so the category I'd put them into.
Is that a good segue into saying, well, that's part of the management of digital identity? It's like, you know, if you want to take care of your identity, you better manage your passwords and maybe your security questions and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, it's a species of it. I mean, smart devices that, you know, have unique identities don't have some of the privacy consequences that people who have digital identities do, but they need to be authenticated. As properly, they need strong authentication the way people probably need more strong authentication. You know, passwords are not the best way to authenticate. We are continually finding better ways, stronger ways to authenticate. It's a good topic. Thinking about 10 years ago and whenever I sat next to a random person on a plane and they asked, what do you do? And I would start by saying, oh, identity and access management or similar. They say, what is that? And I'd say, well, you know, how you log into things online. And then they would launch into a conversation about how, well, I sure hate passwords. The conversation always went. These days, I think they're more inclined to know what two-step verification is, for example. Right. So that's probably a good sign.
So it's interesting. You said that potentially the consequences of identity, the bad consequences of identity is worse for, you know, us humans versus, you know, perhaps an entity. So let's talk about a little bit about responsibility. There was a survey that I came across from Idology, a consumer digital identity study done in 2018. And in that report, they say that 67% of people agree that it's a company's responsibility to protect consumer data, compared to 59% who say it's a consumer's personal responsibility. And it strikes me that perhaps the right answer is maybe, you know, a mix. But in your opinion, where is that weight of responsibility?
Well, as long as organizations hold consumer data, as long as they ask to collect consumer data and use consumer data, which they of course do, ostensibly for the benefit of consumers, of course it's for mutual benefit, it's going to be a large portion of their responsibility to take care of it. So I think it is a mix. The reason why we even have digital identity is that it's a tool for providing services, for providing digital services. And now, interesting digitally infused goods, right? Mm. I mean, there's a customer that my company, Boardrock, has that makes smart basketballs. You know, who knew?
What is a smart basketball?
Yes, I'm interested.
It's amazing. I mean, you know, if you put a chip in a basketball, you can do things like automatically track leaderboards and such.
Wow. I mean, like how many dribbles, that kind of thing?
Oh yeah. So I mean, you can actually keep track of, you know, who's interacting with it, and you can, you know, keep track of who's scoring. And I mean, there's smart skis, there's smart, I mean, six years ago, I used to joke about smart socks. There's going to be smart socks. And at the time I lived in Seattle. And then I discovered there's a company that makes smart socks in Seattle, of course. And there's my new joke is there are no hypothetical products. They all exist and they're all smart now. And the thing is that what's the difference between a smart product and a dumb product? It's data. So to your question, you know, the reason why people are making, you know, all these smart things is it's companies that want to generate data and ingest data, in these cases about consumers. Well, so they do have a responsibility. And because they are coming into contact with this consumer data, they are in effect, you know, if you're thinking about cybersecurity, it becomes toxic.
Yes, I've heard that term. Yeah, toxic data. Exactly. Right? Yeah.
And so their responsibility is to protect it. And, you know, in the EU, the original data protection law was the Data Protection Directive. And so they call data privacy data protection.
Right.
And I mean, that's the very first duty in privacy, is to protect it from getting out.
And they actually make it a distinction about people who handle the data. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily people who originate the data or who store the data,
mm-hmm.
right?
So maybe we should back up a bit and think for a moment. Then what is identity data now? Because I mean, if you just say identity to somebody on the street, they'll probably thinking, you know, their name, maybe their date of birth, maybe, you know, depending on what country you're in, your tax. You know, your tax identification number, whatever.
First thing is like social security number, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, but clearly there's so much more involved in what, you know, the data is as seen in the, you know, GDPR and
personal information, what's known as PII, which is personally identifiable information, which is a subset of personal information, which is anything that's sort of, you know, all on its own would identify you. So the thing is that almost everything is personal information now. And I would recommend to you to go take a look at this website, mycarmydata.eu. It's fascinating. It's run by this organization called FIA Region 1. And FIA is something French. I won't attempt to pronounce it. But they did a number of studies around connected car. And one of them was a legal study. And what they established firmly was that according to GDPR, which they care about, being EU-based, is that things like the oil level in a connected car or the dynamically generated tire pressure as you drive is personal information because there's a registered owner of the car. So when I think about personal data or even identity data or the identity context provided to data, I think extremely broadly. There's the, you know, attributes that might be stored in your identity record by some company. And that's kind of the start of the journey of giving something, infusing identity into something. But then there's all the connections to the, what may be hundreds of applications and devices that, you know, go outward in this kind of spider pattern. And it just touches everything.
So I want to come back to the car thing in a minute. But before we go there, this sounds like an opportune time to say, what are some of the unintended consequences, perhaps, of two bits of data that were perhaps not individually personally identifiable, getting together and identifying you?
Mm-hmm. And making a baby of identification. Well, correlation is just so powerful. And, you know, I do some work in healthcare IT standards. And I'm not a subject matter expert in healthcare, but I know a lot of people who are subject matter experts. And one of the things I've learned about that world and about the regulations there is that there are sort of standards for how much work you have to do around de-identification and how much they'll tolerate around the possibility of re-identification and correlation. Right. And you kind of, there's some best effort that you have to do, and that's, you know, pretty tough. But they acknowledge that, you know, time marches on and it's possible to re-identify and correlate, and it could happen. So, you know, nothing is perfect. And so, you know, people, like, let's say that you allow your data to go to clinical research and it's been de-identified. It's possible you could be re-identified eventually.
Right. In the future.
Yes.
Let's go back to your car analogy. So you said, you know, that the oil level in the car could be traced back to you because you are the registered owner of the car. But let's take the example where that car is being driven by multiple people in a family.
Yep.
Right? And so how do you reconcile that? And sort of a corollary or associate question, which is, are there certain attributes of identity that are actually more sensitive, more valuable than others? So let's say oil level in the car versus genome data. Genome data, it uniquely identifies me, right? But yeah. Whereas perhaps the oil level in a car could be me or could be, you know, my spouse.
Absolutely. And there's definitely more sensitive data, and genome is especially interesting because guess what? It has more than one data subject, as the privacy terminology goes. And we saw that with the Golden State Killer.
That's right.
Sacramento. Explain
what happened, because not everybody might know about that.
So that was a case where they actually got data. I think it was it from Facebook? I can't remember.
There's some sort of a...
Voluntarily.
Ancestry. Yeah, it was Ancestry or 23andMe. Like,
data about themselves. Mm-hmm. But then if you realize your data is your DNA data is actually shared with your siblings and your parents to some degree, you know, to a fairly precise percentage of degree.
Right.
As you go up and down and sideways in your family tree. And so if you share your genome, you're actually sort of inadvertently sharing part of somebody else's genome. And so you can reveal information about other people, and that's kind of what happened. And that's how they found the Golden State Killer.
So the Golden State Killer hadn't necessarily done this sort of genealogy sort of test, but because his family had, they were able to trace him with you know, very good certainty.
That's right. And so there's something that I think we have to realize, which is there's a term that you know, my company and some other companies had come up with some years ago, identity relationship management. So, you know, we've thought for a long time about identity management, which is singular identities. But in fact, as we've entered the world of smart devices or just simply mobile devices that we connect with, and maybe we upgrade to a new phone or we've lost a phone and we have to get a new one with a new SIM card, or we have, you know, this network of smart devices. I now live in this much larger house. I used to have a small condo, and I have motivations now to like have a smart home with smart security and be able to turn off the light upstairs automatically with, you know, what do they call it? A scene, a recipe, whatever it is. And so, you know, now that we have all these devices, we need to have this notion of identity relationships, relationships among multiple identities and between people. And so as we get this more sophisticated view, it's, and particularly with the genome, we start to want to be able to describe the relationships among these identities and to have them change over time. So in an enterprise, we had this nice sort of, well, it was not, we saw it as complicated, but we had things like org charts, which are semi-neat.
Yeah.
We had relationships that were hierarchical-ish.
Right.
And we thought that was complex, but in fact, compared to the real world, which is super messy, we had no idea, you know, what was sort of hitting us. And now we have this sort of consumer world where we're not the boss of them. If we're trying to manage this, you know, world where people can do whatever they want, people can share information that isn't theirs to share because it shares characteristics with other people. And this is the identity world that we're in now that we had no idea about. I mean, we've mapped genomes. I just sent away my puppy's, you know, DNA test, and luckily, knock wood, luckily I don't have to worry about her privacy consequences.
Not yet, maybe later. Those are the
she becomes unintended.
Yes.
Oh my God. So coming back to the car again, I mean, there was recent revelations about just the extent to which the car manufacturers are themselves actually tracking what's going on in your vehicle, and they're collecting data from your vehicle, such as you know, where is it at all times, even if you're not running the nav system, such as how often do you brake hard, such as, you know, what speeds are you going on a regular basis, so on and so forth. And they're not sharing it with you. They view it as their data. But obviously it would have implications for you if it got out, because there isn't anywhere, at least on this continent, not speaking for all continents, where 95 miles an hour is legal.
More's the pity.
Indeed. And you know, what I don't know also is the extent to which they might make that kind of information available if your car gets stolen, for instance. If they know where your car is and they're not telling you, is that perhaps not setting up a problem?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those conundrums that we face is, you know, that there is technically no concept of data ownership. And this has been a matter of some contention, actually worldwide, is, you know, property is a bundle of sticks. So it's a matter of controllership of, you know, some property rights, digital asset rights. And we sure, I think, would like to know how we can control the rights, more rights in our digital assets. Mm-hmm. How do we get those rights? Well, we have to have a practical means of controlling them. This is one of the reasons why I work on the user managed access standard, in fact, so that, you know, we can have practical, convenient, value add ways to share out access to our own data and not have to, like, you know, have it sit with us, because, you know, some of that data is streaming data. It doesn't live at rest anywhere.
Right. So, I mean, on that topic, it strikes me that, you know, right now I can use my, if I can go to a site and I don't want to necessarily register and give them all my information, I can log in with my Google, I can log in with my Facebook, I can log in and pay with my Amazon account. Mm-hmm. Is that what you are talking about in terms of user managed access, or is it something different? Is it a different model than giving all of our data to these big, you know, companies?
Well, giving all our data to these big companies doesn't sound like a very attractive proposition necessarily.
Yeah.
That model of what you're describing is a social sign-in proposition. And that's a model of identity that has been quite successful in the last 5-6 years, actually. And the social sign-in model, people are familiar with that now, I think, right? This sign-in with Google and so on. And I have to say, that's been one of the big successes of federated identity.
Why do you think it's been successful? I mean, is it just the convenience
factor? One password,
yeah.
and you have a recognized, you recognize that this is the company and they're going to take care of me, so on and so forth. And
well, it's reusing something you've got. And I have to say that it was a bit of a tough sell. When we think back to our Liberty Alliance standards days, we weren't sure that proposition was going to succeed, building that Liberty stuff and building the SAML standard, actually. We were, inventing cross-domain single sign-on and federated identity, which is essentially flinging sensitive identity information across the internet. Mm. And you have to do it securely, and you have to be sure that somebody wants you to do it, because the parties there, you've got a user who wants to log in successfully somewhere. You've got an identity provider that's willing to, authenticate them. And then you've got this relying party, the service provider, that, doesn't want the liability of holding their password or whatever it is, but wants them logged in and is willing to outsource that job. Right. And the question was always, are they going to be willing to outsource it and, have that stuff flung across the internet to them? With SAML, we discovered there was a small market for it. It's gotten bigger and bigger, in the sort of, enterprise context. And then when OpenID Connect, the standard, got invented, it was built on top of this OAuth thing. And that's where you see the sign-in with Google, the sign-in with Facebook and everything, that social sign-in proposition. That's when, some people did some hard work to discover that there was a bigger relying party market for it. And that was actually kind of exciting. Because who knew, that you could actually outsource an authentication job. And so here we are. The user managed access proposition goes a little bit farther. It says, are you willing to outsource the job? Are you, service provider, willing to outsource the job of authorization? So that users can choose to share access to their online stuff with others, and you'll be able to add a share button, Google Docs-like, to your stuff. So think like, you can add a wish list share button. You can add a, like Tripit has a share your itinerary button. You can add that button to your service, but not have to handle the, generating of the access token. The access token just comes back to you and you do what it says.
So you're basically setting policies as to what you are willing to share, mm-hmm. right?
The users, yeah.
Yeah, because whereas, with Facebook login or the Google login, I have no idea how much, I do a lot of stuff, with my searches with Google, right? Mm-hmm. Or my social media, my list of friends and what I like and what I dislike. I don't know whether that's also being shared with another vendor. I have no mm-hmm. idea, right? Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this proposition is a lot more like, right now in the healthcare industry in the US, there's a lot of pressure on healthcare providers and on healthcare payers, insurance providers, to say you can no longer block people from getting access to their information or from having them share that information, whether it's electronic healthcare records or claims information or prescription information. Mm. With caregivers, with you want to get a second opinion, or with a spouse, or all kinds of people, and they're kind of scrambling to figure out how to do it.
It's interesting because that's a whole area that more or less started very strongly from the privacy stance, and is only sort of backfilling electronic access, digital access, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
As opposed to the rest of the world, which the inverse way of it, like as you say, the healthcare, the access to healthcare information in the U.S. is really tightly clamped down and not to the patient's benefit in the end, although we can go into stories of what happens when information gets out. My husband is a professor at a university, and so he's got a very clear understanding of all of the rules and regulations over what he can divulge about, you know, his students, even to their parents.
Yeah,
like he can't confirm that a certain person is or is not in his class, even to their parents.
Yeah, we've got a circumstance. I was just learning. I'm going to an internal conference in another country, and apparently we're not allowed to ask if there are any food allergies for anybody who's signing up to go to the conference.
Wow.
Why? Because what would that do?
Apparently, it is a violation of people's privacy to even ask them if they are allergic to nuts.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, people who have actual serious allergies are like, I bet I want to tell you.
Yeah, they want to tell everybody.
Food. I know. Yes. I think this is why I say privacy is not secrecy. Privacy is not encryption. Privacy is context, control, choice, and respect. And every part of that is important. I mean, if privacy were pure secrecy, you know, then we wouldn't be saying anything to each other. It's selective sharing. The proposition of UMA is actually selective sharing. It's a positive vision of sharing what you want to share. Rather
say
than
that again. That's really interesting. You said privacy is context sensitive.
Context, control, choice. Uh-huh. And respect. And that's a very hard thing to do, right? I mean, if privacy were just data protection, well then, you know, you get good at locking everything down and you're done. But we know that people are dissatisfied, unsatisfied with, you know, no consumer is happy with everybody doing a good job of breach notification laws, because breaches would still happen. You get notified, you get handed an 800 number for, you know, Equifax services and you're done. Well, that's not privacy.
Right.
Privacy has got to be something more than that. So, okay. Privacy is not encryption, because first of all, if you lean too hard on encryption as an answer, you're counting on a whole bunch of math to just work, and it's not sensitive to experience or interface, and math fails us pretty frequently. I mean, I just saw where, you know, Bitcoin Gold just had a 51% attack, just as one example.
Wow.
So yeah, and part of the problem there too is that often, you know, if you just try, if your entire defense mechanism is to lock everything down through encryption and so on and so forth, you run the risk of making something that is also completely unusable.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm suspicious.
For legitimate purposes, not just.
Yeah. Privacy engineering is not a bad field, but it oftentimes does not take account of user experience. So it's just not complete.
Right.
So and privacy and security have an overlap. They have a Venn overlap, but there's more.
So we're getting close to time and we should probably wrap up. So one question I know I would like to be sure to ask you is, effectively, what does good look like? You know, from here going forward, say 10 years, in terms of the evolution of the technology and its consequences, what do you want to see happen?
Well, I think I might have mentioned identity relationship management. I'd like to see relationships, human to organization relationships, human-to-human relationships, and human to all the things in their lives, relationships, have the premium put on them as the thing to be managed. Digital identity and digital identities are a tool. They're the tool that we have alighted upon, we in the IT world have alighted upon to solve a problem. And it may be that that is the tool we sort of stick with for a long time, a longer time, a shorter time, as our conception of how to bring these relationships to better fruition. I'm always looking for, you know, more equitable relationships to bring people to a sort of a level of more being more of a peer to organizations.
There's that idealism.
I know. Yeah. Silly me banging my head against that wall.
Yeah.
But you know, I once did a panel last year with some folks from the Better Identity Coalition. And it was a really interesting bunch of folks. There's a thing called the Better Identity Coalition. And I think they're relatively new. And at the time, anyway, they were saying, well, they're going to come up with metrics for, you know, how we can tell if we're doing identity better. And I was so curious. I was like, well, what does that mean? Does it mean we have more identities? Fewer passwords? No passwords? One identity? I think one identity is a bad idea. We'd correlate all of our activity online, probably. And I just tend to think that those are all input metrics. We need the right output metrics. And I think it's better, healthier relationships with the organizations that give us digital services. That's where I want to be.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. So I have a question, I guess, following on Leslie's and the theme of the show, which is consequences. And I wonder if this is sort of, this is a consequence that's going to happen whether we intend it or not. And that is really the digital divide. So yeah, there's a 2018 report on the economic impact of digital identity. And it says that 1/3 of the children susceptible to violence, mostly in Asia and Africa, have births that were not registered. And so, you know, we're talking about attributes such as genome, you know, cars, IoT devices. These are all sort of things that are happening in developed economies. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a whole other part of the world that's still struggling to have, you know, clean water. So this is mm-hmm. not sort of top of agenda. And so is this digital identity going to further deepen the divide between the haves and the have-nots?
So, Alexa, I was trying to go out on a high note, just putting that out there. So we may need to have yet another final question.
that's you.
Over to you, Eve.
I mean, I honestly don't know how to answer that question. I mean, this is not an answer to that question, but it is something in the vicinity of that question, which is, I would simply caution us to not necessarily apply digital identity to developing nations to think that it is necessarily an answer to problems such as that. Mm-hmm. I think it's sometimes easy to say, giving everybody a digital identity is going to help with that problem. It'll help with registering births.
Like a panacea type.
For example, yes. It could be, I mean, looking, for example, at, you know, doing elections better, maybe going back to paper would be a great answer.
Yes.
So, you know,
paper ballots. Yes. We can have a whole other conversation. Yes, right? Paper ballots so are
just,
the way to go. Yeah.
Just sort of, you know, let's not necessarily run to digital for everything. Let's take each step as it comes.
Very good. Good answer. It wasn't necessarily a downer, was it, Leslie?
No, I think that's a very thoughtful,
I hope not.
Very thoughtful close.
I like to be practical.
Yes.
In my idealism.
There we go. Well, and there we've done it. We've managed to spend more than 30 minutes having a very entertaining discussion, and I'm sure we could go for another 30 minutes, but we better let Eve and you, our listeners, go. So with that, I'll say thank you very much, Eve, for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod, and you can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this podcast or ideas for future episodes. Be sure to catch all the episodes in this privacy and security arc, including conversations with Mark Rotenberg, Suzanne Wolf, and Eve Mailer. You can follow TechSequences on Twitter to hear about new episodes and topic arcs. Thanks for listening.